Iambic Audiobooks and Tigris Books present Late Rain by Lynn Kostoff. Read by Kenneth Campbell. Part 1, Chapter 1. Patience was always a sucker's game. The way Corinne Tedros saw it, the me could take their places, dutifully line up and patiently stand there until eternity tapped them on the shoulder and judgment day rolled around. But the only portion of the earth that they would ever lay claim to or ever call their own was the portion that had been, and forever would be, embedded beneath their fingernails. Corinne understood the difference between patience and waiting. Sunday afternoons, however, were a different story. Corinne felt as if she were trapped within a single moment, the same one opening and unfolding over and over again. 14 months of Sunday afternoons in Magnolia Beach, South Carolina, and having to sit across the dining room table from her husband's uncle, Stanley Tedros. Stanley, wearing the same brown suit and starched white shirt buttoned all the way to the neck, each week as he held court, shoveling food and talking at the same time. It wasn't a pretty sight, and for that matter, neither was Stanley. A gnome, that's what he reminded Corinne of. One of those ceramic lawn ornaments. You could stick him in somebody's front yard, and nobody would know the difference. By all rights, Stanley should have been in the ground years ago. He was old, his odometer clocking 85, and when Corinne had married Buddy 14 months before, she had assumed, erroneously as it turned out, that Stanley wouldn't be around for long. Stanley liked to tell everybody he was too busy to die. Today, Stanley was riding one of his favorite topics, the current shabby state of American culture. "My parents weren't born here," he said. "They were immigrants and saw the country for what it was, and they made themselves Americans. They didn't have a lifestyle, they had a life. Nobody understands the difference anymore." Corinne looked down at her plate. Nothing different there either. The same meal Stanley made ashore preparing each Sunday. Pot roast and a pile of vegetables that had been boiled so long that the color had leached from them. And to drink, a can of julep, of course. Julep was Stanley's cash cow. Before it hit the market, Stanley had been nothing more than a third-tier bottler and distributor of a line of generic soft drinks, the anonymous six-for-a-dollar variety cluttering the lower shelves in a Piggly Wiggly or Winn-Dixie. Julep changed all that, starting out with a strong regional following, and then unexpectedly catching national attention when Jack Brandt, star of the hit TV series Firing Pin, closed a season with an on-site filming in South Carolina and shipped 30 cases of julep to L.A. and served it at a heavily media-covered bash he threw to celebrate the six-month anniversary of his graduation from detox to sobriety. After that, julep caught on big. Corinne looked up from her plate. Stanley was still talking and chewing. "At bottom," Stanley said, "everything's a question of character. Always has been." She watched him wave a fork at Buddy. No, Corinne thought, keeping her expression neutral. At bottom, it was an older story. Luck and timing. That's what mattered. You kept your eyes open and your hands free. When you saw what you wanted, you grabbed. She had learned that lesson by the time she turned 8. Stanley set down his fork and got up from the table. "Time for side B," he said, before disappearing into the living room. That was another element in the Sunday afternoon ritual that Corinne had to endure, Stanley's taste in music. He alternated every other week with his favorite albums. This afternoon it was the Broadway version of Zorba the Greek. Last Christmas, in an admittingly transparent conciliatory gesture that she hoped would cut some of the tension that existed between Stanley and her, Corinne had bought a state-of-the-art sound system and the CDs of Zorba and Savannah Yanatow, Harris Alexio, Angela Dimitriou, Stella Konstantopoulou. A hit parade of names she had no idea how to pronounce. Stanley, however, characteristically went on and undercut the gesture, making a show of thanking Corinne, but then saying he would stick with the ancient turntable and albums, maintaining they best captured the authentic qualities of the music. From the living room came the opening strains of Only Love. Corinne looked over at her husband. Buddy shifted slightly in his seat and still wore the all-purpose smile, easygoing and deferential, that substituted for sustained thought and a backbone when he was around his uncle. "When?" Corinne asked. "I haven't forgotten," he said. "I'm just waiting for the right opportunity." "Now, Buddy," Corinne said. He nodded, his gaze grazing hers, and when Stanley returned from the living room, Buddy cleared his throat and finally got around to the subject of the buyouts, asking Stanley if he didn't think it might be a good idea to meet with the reps again and reconsider what they were offering. "You know," Buddy said, "just listen, that's all. Keep an open mind, it can't hurt."
"Hyenas," Stanley said around a mouthful of pot roast. "Nothing else but. All of them."
Stanley chewed and looked over at Corinne. He had the mien of a prosecuting attorney who'd just finished his closing statement to a jury he knew he had in his pocket. Despite herself, Corinne felt the hairs on her arms rise. Buddy cleared his throat again and gamely went on, "I mean James Reston, just as an example. He put together a very attractive package. You sell, you'll be doing all right."
"How about Anita Duford?" Stanley asked.
"Who?" Buddy quickly glanced over at Corinne and then back to his uncle.
"Anita Duford," Stanley said. "You think she'll be doing all right if we take Reston's offer? Reston's or either of the other two nosing around?"
"I don't know any Anita Duford," Buddy said.
"That's because you don't pay attention. I introduced you."
Stanley leaned forward in his seat.
"Anita's 42, 5 kids and a grandmother 3 times over. Quit school in the 8th grade. Couple of husbands along the way, never stuck around. Sings in the choir at Ironwood Baptist. Makes a nice pecan pie. Has worked on the line first shift for 16 years. Missed 3 days of work in the last 5 years.
Stanley speared 2 stalks of asparagus, folded them around his fork and jammed them into his mouth, and continued,
"What do you think's going to happen to Anita when Reston takes over and starts restructuring?"
"He said there'd be minimal cuts," Buddy said quickly. "He stressed that."
"You want to be the one to explain that to Anita, Buddy? Or Laura Hilburn, or Hank Owen, or Brenda White? Or any of the others you forgot the name of that'll be shown the door if we sign over Stanco Beverages to James Reston?"
Stanley picked up his knife, carved another slab of pot roast, and dropped it on his plate.
"Stanco's mine," he said, "and it'll stay that way. I've got my own plans for distribution."
Corinne imagined Stanley choking on a piece of food. A chunk of boiled potato, say, or a nice rare wad of pot roast. Stanley's face going as red as her nails. Corinne sitting back and enjoying the show. Her husband Buddy would be of no help, as clueless as ever when it came to acting decisively, and Stanley Tedros would gasp and thrash his way to a slow and painful death. Corinne snapped back to the afternoon as Stanley said,
"God gave man 2 heads, Buddy, but just enough blood to make one of them work."
He pointed his fork and, around a mouthful of food, delivered a follow-up that Corinne almost missed. The air left the room. Corinne dropped her silverware and pushed back her plate. "Are you going to let him get away with that?" she asked. She brushed Buddy's hand off her arm. "Are you?" she repeated. Buddy adjusted the tiny collar on his dark blue polo shirt. "Just calm down, okay? He called me a hooker." Buddy frowned. "He did? You sure? You're going to just sit there? But he lifted, then dropped his hand. Stanley tapped the side of his glass with a fork.
Okay there, enough.
He paused and probed his upper plate, using his index finger to adjust the fit of his dentures. His eyes never left Corinne's.
I was explaining a basic truth to Buddy, he said finally, about God giving man two heads.
I heard that, Corinne interrupted, and I heard what you said afterwards. You said, and that's what you get for marrying a hooker, Buddy.
Looker. I said that's what you got, Buddy. A looker.
You're lying, Stanley. I heard what I heard. Corinne, Buddy began, but she told him to shut up. Her hands had begun to tremble, and Corinne dropped them into her lap, balled them into fists. Something lurched in her stomach. Stanley went back to cutting his meat. Corinne knew she should drop the whole thing, but she couldn't shake Stanley's mocking smile or the way his eyes had zeroed in on hers when she challenged him. Her anger pushed her on, and she leaned forward and said, "You couldn't pay a hooker enough to fuck you, Stanley." He barked out a short laugh, then winked.
"You might be surprised, Corinne."
He paused and shrugged.
"And then again, maybe not."
Corinne turned to Buddy. "I want to go home now." Stanley waved off her words.
"A little misunderstanding," he said. "That's all it was. You need to be more forgiving, Corinne. You're too high-strung."
"I don't think so."
"Hey, what are we talking about here? Words, that's all. Sticks and stones and all that."
He paused and ran a napkin across his mouth.
"Just words, Corinne. Besides, if you think about it, can't a looker be a hooker or a hooker be a looker? It's like the song says, you say potato, I say potato. Any way you slice it in the end, you're still looking at French fries."
"I'm leaving, Buddy. I'll wait for you in the living room."
"Hey, what about dessert?"
Stanley said, not bothering to get up when Corinne walked past. The living room bore the stamp of Stanley's origins. It was dreary and oppressive and cluttered, and despite Stanley's net worth, relentlessly blue collar in its furnishings and decor. He was living in the same North Shore neighborhood and the same house he'd bought when he'd moved to Magnolia Beach. Nobody upon entering it would find any sign of what Stanley was actually worth. Buddy's voice carried from the dining room as he tried to placate Stanley. Corinne walked over to the turntable as side B of Zorba the Greek finished. She watched the arm lift and return to rest. Then she opened her purse. It took her a while to find her nail file. End of chapter 1.